The Leslie Marshall Show, a true democracy in talk radio. Of, for, and by you, the people.
Live from our nation's capital, it's Deadline DC with Brad Bannon.
Welcome to Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. I'm Brad Bannon, the host of Deadline DC. I'm a national Democratic strategist and pollster, a columnist for The Hill in Washington, D.C., and a political analyst for News Radio KNX in Los Angeles. By the way, if you want to read my new column in The Hill on Earth Day, you can check it out at muckrack.com. That's muckrack, all one word. muckrack.com/Brad Bannon. My company, Bannon Communications Research, polls for progressive issue groups, labor unions, and Democrats. Mondays on Deadline DC, I talk to the people and players behind the politics and policies that drive our great nation forward. With us, as usual, is our intrepid executive producer, Mark Grimaldi, who keeps the show online and makes sure the trains run on time. We've got two great guests this afternoon on Deadline DC. Our guest in the first half hour is Bob Deans, the Director of Strategic Engagement for the National Resources Defense Council. He's here to help us celebrate Earth Day 2024. Then in the second half hour, Teresa Purcell, the founder of the Rural Strength Network, discusses the Democratic problems performing in rural areas. Before we get to our first guest, Bob Deans, we're going to play this clip. And this is it's Aidan Chiron, who is the head of the End Plastics campaign, talking about the theme for this year's Earth Day.
The Earth Day theme for 2024 is Planet versus Plastics, to bring attention to the health implications of plastic, as well as bring attention to the global plastics treaty that we're currently negotiating and hope to finish by the end of 2024. And we're hoping with that we're going to see production cuts. So EarthDay.org is calling for a 60% reduction of production by 2040. We believe this is really achievable just because 50% of all plastic is single-use plastic, as well as 50% of that 50% is packaging. And the amount of packaging we have on all of our food and all of our clothing and everything we see is just too much, and we can't recycle our way out of this problem, and we're not going to be able to take our way out of this problem. This Earth Day, you should think about buying reusable Tupperware made from glass rather than plastic, as well as buying reusable water bottles made out of stainless steel or glass rather than plastics due to their harmful leaching of additive chemicals. For Earth Day 2024, we expect 3 billion people to celebrate worldwide.
That was Aidan Chiron, head of the End Plastics campaign, talking about Earth environmental goals on Earth Day 2024. Our guest in this half hour is Bob Deans, who visits us frequently here on Deadline DC with Brad Bannon, and we are grateful for that. Bob is Director of Strategic Engagement at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Bob, welcome to Deadline DC and happy Earth Day.
Happy Earth Day to you, Brad. Great to be with you.
First, Bob, this is an anniversary, so let's talk about what kind of progress have we made cleaning up the environment and fighting climate change since the first Earth Day?
Enormous amount. Of course, Senator Gaylord Nelson from Wisconsin kicked this all off in 1970. We had some 20 million Americans turned out for that first Earth Day. It was inspired by the Vietnam War, anti-war movement. Let's get people out in the streets talking about what matters to us. And since then, of course, it's billowed, as you just heard, 3 billion people globally now participate in the annual Earth Day event. So it's a big campaign for raising our awareness. We've made enormous strides in cleaning up our rivers, cleaning up our air, enormous improvements in public health as a result of that. And the big challenge overarching now, of course, Brad, is climate change. And one little thing for people to remember where we have gone backwards since 1970. Since 1970, we have burned more oil, coal, and gas globally than in all of history before then. Not just a little bit more, Brad. We've burned three times as much coal, oil, and gas since that first Earth Day in 1970 as in all of history before that. We have increased the amount of carbon in the Earth's atmosphere by 30% to its highest level in more than 3 million years. That's happened, Brad, just since Earth Day.
Okay, let me, you heard the clip from, Aidan Sharon. He talked about goals. Do those strike you as reasonable goals? Do they go far enough? Can we reach them?
They're certainly achievable goals. Cutting the production of plastic 60% by 2030, another decade and a half. And look, we've got a real problem here, Brad. There's not a place on this planet you can go to anymore that hasn't been polluted by plastics. You find microplastics in birds out in islands, the Midway Islands in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. You'll see birds that have died from eating plastic that's washed up on the shore that they picked up in the ocean. In our bloodstreams, you can't hardly find a human being anywhere on the planet that doesn't have these microplastics in our bloodstream. So this is a real problem. It has to be dealt with. It's an achievable goal. We need to set our minds to it, achieving it.
Okay, Bob, the title of my Earth Day column in The Hill is the clock is ticking and the Earth is taking a licking. Is that accurate or not?
That nails it, Brad. I haven't seen the column. I look forward to reading it, but that's clearly where we are right now. We just found that the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere now reached a new high, 424 parts per million. That might not sound like a lot, but again, as we've just talked about, it's 30% more than we had just in 1970. So that's got to change. We saw the consequences last year. Two-thirds of Americans under the threat of dangerous heat waves last summer. The Mississippi River at an all-time low due to drought just last fall. Canadian wildfires that torched enough land to cover the state of Oklahoma. So the crisis is dire. We need to act. Here's the great news. We are taking action, more action than ever in the past 3 years, where we have seen the Inflation Reduction Act, something like $120 billion in corporate investment as a result of that act, helping us to build new factories that are going to make solar panels, wind turbines, electric vehicles, and advanced batteries in this country, in red states and blue, Brad. We have seen the methane rule that the administration finalized in December that's going to cut that climate super pollutant. We have seen new rules just last month to clean up the tailpipe emissions from our cars and pickup trucks and vans. And on this Thursday, we're going to end finally the era of unbridled carbon pollution from the nation's power plants when the Biden administration issues new standards to cut that pollution, Brad. So we're making enormous progress. In fact, due to these four major measures that the administration has taken and the investment that we're seeing from private corporations and the state and local action that we're seeing, the country is now on track, Brad, to cut our greenhouse gas emissions 42% below 2005 levels by 2030. That's well on the way to where we need to be, which is to cut that pollution in half by 2030. With greater ambition, we can get there, Brad.
Okay, Bob, let me ask you, a week ago Sunday, I read an editorial in the Washington Post about carbon dioxide emissions. And basically, the point the Post made was that if you look at the world, the United States and the G7 countries in Europe have made significant progress cutting carbon dioxide emissions, but that has been overset by an increased carbon emissions in developing nations, and the two biggest offenders were China and India. And the Post proposed essentially increasing tariffs on goods from countries like China and India that are not meeting carbon dioxide emission goals. How do you feel about that?
Well, a couple of things to remember. First, when you look at China and India, between the two of them, almost 3 billion people out of a global population of just under 8 billion. So that's a significant part of the world. They are both growing rapidly, China more so than any country in the history of the world. So we understand that's going to take a lot of energy. But the issue here is fairness and effectiveness. We've got to address this carbon footprint globally. It's a global problem. Everybody's got to be part of the fix.
Now, China, Bob, I'm going to have to interrupt you. We've got to go to break. Welcome to Deadline DC. We're going to take a break for our radio listeners. Our guest in this half hour, Bob Deans from the Natural Resources Defense Council, will still be with us when we get back from the commercial break. Okay. Welcome back to Deadline DC with Brad Bannon, and welcome back to our radio listeners. By the way, for our radio listeners, if you'd like to watch Deadline DC with Brad Bannon as well as listen to it, you can do that at twitter.com/Brad Bannon or on facebook.com/DeadlineDC with Brad Bannon /videos. We have another clip to play. It's President Biden's message for Earth Day 2024.
Happy Earth Day. Today, I'm reminded of the work we must do to protect our future generations and continue the historic progress we're making. It starts with my Inflation Reduction Act, most significant investment in climate, clean energy, and environmental justice ever. Builds on our global leadership. After we rejoined the Paris Agreement, set standards to cut pollution, quadrupled the number of electric vehicles sold, and sparked the U.S. manufacturing boom that's created 270,000 clean energy jobs and counting. And today, for the first time, Americans can apply to join my American Climate Corps, so everyone has a pathway to a clean energy career. And we're also announcing a $7 billion award through the Solar for All program to cut utility bills for nearly 1 million low-income households. Folks, we're making progress, and we're just getting started. On Earth Day, let's remember there's nothing beyond our capacity when we act together.
I'm just going to pinch hit here for a moment. This is Mark Grimaldi, the producer. We're just getting Brad back on, who had a technical problem. Bob, I could talk to you all day. We go way back. So let me ask you this question, Bob. When you hear the president talk about those accomplishments, I know you've outlined them in detail in the beginning. There's a lot of discussion around younger voters and attracting younger voters to the president. And, you know, this program that was announced today has been listed as something that is not only geared towards younger voters and people who are concerned about the environment, but also people who are in communities that have been disproportionately affected by climate change. And it's going to be targeted in those areas where it could affect and could help up to 1 million households become powered by solar panels. And it is aiming to target 200,000 jobs under this green bank that was part of, I believe, was it part of the Inflation Reduction Act, Bob?
It's part of the Inflation Reduction Act.
Okay, yes, and that's where the funds will be drawn from. What is your impression of this program, and how feasible do you think it is? Because it sounds like it's well thought out, but you know, we have to obviously move forward and see how it goes.
Absolutely. The president talked today about two things that the youth really care about. One is action and the other is progress. People are tired of words. They're tired of empty promises. And what you've been seeing from this administration are those two things, action and progress. The American Climate Corps that he talked about is a pipeline to get young people engaged in working on climate adaptation, climate mitigation, and also making our communities more resilient. So they're learning the skills to do that. What he announced today were these first 2,000 of 20,000 jobs that are coming out for this. And those first 2,000 members of the American Climate Corps will go to work in June, Mark. So it's right around the corner. And they're preparing for futures. They're going to be apprenticing, learning the trades that we need, you know, to make your home more efficient. We need roofers, we need carpenters, we need plumbers to electrify the nation. We need journeyman electricians. This is all about training people and moving in that direction, those who want to go there. The other piece of it is environmental justice that you mentioned. Part of the Inflation Reduction Act was a $27 billion program to be administered by the EPA to make sure that marginalized communities, low-income communities, people of color who have been overlooked and are on the front lines of climate and hazard and harm, that they are benefiting from these investments. And so what the president said today is we're announcing $7 billion of that $27 billion in grants to make solar panels available to, as you said, these 900,000 homes in marginalized communities around the country, saving these folks about $400 a year in their electricity bill. Those are big savings, particularly for low-income folks, Mark. So all of this is important. And what the president is saying is we're going to take action, we're going to make progress, and we're going to keep moving forward.
Bob, let me ask you another question about that, because I do think you really can point to a massive amount of progress now, and it's not just one or two things. This has really become a major part of President Biden's legacy here and this administration. So if we can look ahead, what type of goals does it look like this administration is setting for a potential second term, and what could that mean for our planet?
Well, great question. And remember that when this president took office 3 years ago, he inherited a climate policy that was in shambles, that had been driven to ruin by a previous administration that denied the science and did everything it could to prevent the government from taking action and just championed fossil fuels at every turn. And so we've seen a 180-degree change from that. And that's important. What we need to see going forward is in the coming weeks, the president is going to join leaders from nearly 200 other countries to lay out our climate goals out through 2035 under the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. It's going to be important that we have leaders around the country at the federal, state, and local levels who work to achieve those goals, not who are going to break our promise to the rest of the world and condemn our children to catastrophic climate change, Mark.
And looking at the specific discussion that's going on around this Earth Day, where the discussion is focused on planet versus plastics, I know we only heard just kind of a little bit of that, but to close out here, why is that such an important focus right now, Bob?
It's so important because plastics are poisoning the planet, the people, our ecosystems. These plastics do not biodegrade, obviously. They stick around forever. They get into our food, our air, our blood, and it needs to be addressed. We just can't continue the way we have been. And so the goal of cutting plastics production 60% by 2040 needs to be a global goal. That's going to require U.S. global leadership. And we need a leader who's going to take that mantle on.
Speaking of that, just closing out here, and I'm sorry, I'm only giving you 60 seconds here. It does seem a lot of the shift has gone to trying to cut off production because we've found that it's so hard to recycle plastic. Can you speak about that a little bit, Bob?
Absolutely. And it requires some change in habits, some change in mindset. You know, it's not really a hard thing to fill up a water bottle on your way out the door instead of grabbing a plastic bottle at the 7-Eleven. It just takes a little different mindset. It's not a big deal to stop packing our food in plastic bags that get thrown away and instead put them in Tupperware like our moms did. It's just a matter of changing the way we think about it. But at the production level, there needs to be systemic change. There need to be incentives for the industries to change. And so that's what this is all about, Mark.
Bob, thank you as always. You can check out more of Bob's work at NRDC's website, nrdc.org. We'll talk to you soon, Bob, and Brad will be right back after this break.
Happy Earth Day, Mark.
Happy Earth Day, Bob.
Welcome back to Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. We're now in the second half of the show. I want to thank Bob Deans from the Natural Resources Defense Council for joining us to celebrate Earth Day in the first half hour. Our guest in the second half hour is Teresa Purcell, who is the founder of the Rural Strength Network. And the topic for the day is going to be democratic strength in rural areas, or lack of theirs. First, though, we have this clip about President Biden speaking to rural voters.
In Minnesota today, President Biden kicked off a new campaign to reach rural voters as he struggles to sell his economic message. Gabe Gutierrez is there.
At his Iowa farm, Dave Struthers has been producing pork for decades. But these last few years, he says, have been a struggle.
We've had high costs, and our product we produce has not risen in value correspondingly.
Inflation has hit rural households harder than the rest of the country. According to researchers at Iowa State University, rural households spent an extra $5,500 last year.
We're the people that produce the food and manufacture a lot of the goods. We seem to be ignored just because we don't have the population.
Meanwhile, researchers at Cornell estimate that 94% of the nation's job growth has happened in urban counties since the year 2000. So today, here in Minnesota, President Biden literally barnstorming, kicking off a two-week blitz of rural America.
It's about restoring pride in the rural to rural communities that have been left behind for far too long.
The administration touting more than $5 billion in federal funding to help create jobs, connect more rural areas to broadband, as well as promote farming techniques that fight climate change. The new push is urgent and could be critical to Democrats in 2024.
Despite what everyone is saying, the economy's been humming along pretty well.
Dairy farmers Stephen and Jody Olson Reed think the president is on the right track.
I don't blame Biden for inflation. I blame corporate greed.
But former President Trump has kept widening his lead among rural voters. And according to Pew Research, Republicans got 69% of the rural vote in the 2022 midterms.
Okay. Our guest in this half hour with that backdrop is Teresa Purcell, who's the founder of the Rural Strength Network. First, Teresa, thanks for joining us today. Let's start off with, why don't you tell our listeners and viewers what the Rural Strength Network is and how to find out more about it.
Actually, Brad, it's the Rural Strong Network, and how to find out more about it is ruralstrong.us. Just visit us online at ruralstrong.us. And we're just getting started, but the goal of the Rural Strong Network is to basically empower local people to connect with their friends and neighbors on strengthening our communities, advancing democratic values, and making government work. One of the things
you sent me these numbers, which I find astounding. In 1992, President Bill Clinton, candidate Bill Clinton, won 1,117 rural counties across the nation. In 2008, candidate Barack Obama won 455 counties in rural America. And in 2020, when Joe Biden beat Donald Trump, President Biden won only 147 or something like that counties?
194 counties.
184. What happened? I mean, the Democratic vote in rural areas has been nosediving. And they mentioned in that clip there, in 2022 midterm elections, Democratic congressional candidates got only 36% of the vote in rural areas. So what's going on here? That's pretty dramatic.
Well, the Democratic Party quit showing up in rural America. I mean, to be perfectly honest, that's a huge part of what happened was we haven't shown up for folks there. The Democratic Party has been, and this isn't to say that there aren't Democrats in those places or there aren't people who are not supporters of Donald Trump, but a huge part of what's going on in rural America is that we actually haven't shown up and people are intimidated. The far right has, you know, if everywhere you look, there's a Trump sign, you assume that your friends and neighbors and the people in your community are Trump supporters because there's been no counter narrative. That there just hasn't been, people have not been showing up and connecting with rural people. We spend hundreds of millions of dollars on television every year telling people how great the economy is when that's just not our experience. I live in a rural county. I live in a factory town where over the past 30 years, we haven't built anything. You know, we have not, our health outcomes. When I ran in 2016 as a Democrat and I lost by 559 votes in it out of 57,000 cast in an environment where Donald Trump got Donald Trump won between 7 and 30 percentage points in the 5 counties that this district represents. And so out of 57,000 votes cast, I lost, and I'm an incredible Democrat.
Okay. Let me ask you this, Teresa.
Hello?
Teresa, you still with us?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Let me ask you this. I want you to explain something. One of the things you just said. When you say Democrats don't show up in rural areas, what exactly do you mean by that?
I mean, Democratic candidates don't show up. I mean, 70% of rural counties, the offices go unchallenged. The Republicans go unchallenged. It doesn't feel safe to run as a Democrat right now. And statewide candidates don't show up. You know, I live in Reed Luzenkamp Perez's district, which was one of the biggest upsets in 2022. And I was an advisor to that campaign. And you know, all the advice she was getting from the political elites was to not even bother with rural places. And she showed up and she used the word rural and she talked about rural people and rural issues. And she outperformed Patty Murray in each of those counties by about 5 percentage points. And she only won by 2,400 votes. And so when you show up in our communities, you actually, people want to hear from somebody. They will vote for somebody who's talking about issues that matter to their lives.
Okay. Let me ask you this question. I think that many Democrats have this stereotype of rural areas. And you sent me an article. Someone wrote an article about rural white rage. And basically they're a whole bunch of Klansmen and all sorts of crazy people running around in rural areas. And, you know, I mean, I think you're examining a real problem here because basically my sense is the average, you know, Democratic strategy usually is to run up big numbers in big cities, to run up, to be competitive, competitively win suburban areas and basically hope for the best in rural areas. Is that a fair assessment of national Democratic strategy?
Yeah, and it's failing us. We now have a Republican Supreme Court where we have to go win at state levels. And I want to talk a lot about the implementation. Joe Biden is making, and Democrats in Congress are making transformative investments in rural America right now. And there's two challenges. One is no one knows about it, about these investments. And two is making sure those investments are hitting the ground. And that when I was listening to your Earth Day episode, part of the show. And what's so interesting is implementation of all of the federal policies require electing the right people in rural America. One of the biggest barriers to implementation of both the climate change policy for wind and solar requires county commissioners. Conservation districts are huge parts of implementing the Climate Conservation Corps. So we have lots of great work to do. And I know we have to go to a break in just a minute, but I'd love to talk more about how we engage rural people.
We will, and you're right. We do have to go to a break right now. Our guest on Deadline DC with Brad Bannon is Teresa Purcell, the founder of the Rural Strength Network. We'll be right back after we take this short break for our radio listeners.
Democrats traditionally do not do well in rural districts. What made your campaign different, and how can other rural Democrats hopefully apply that to their campaigns in the future?
Well, I mean, I think one of the critical differences is, you know, my biography. I live in a rural district. I live in rural Skamania County and Timber County. I work in the trades. I own an auto repair and machine shop with my husband. You know, we're a small business that, like you said, we've been broken into four times, had another break-in yesterday. And I think that really connects with Americans. Like, we just want a Congress that works again. We want a Congress that looks like America, that understands what it's like to try and run a small business in this economy and make a place for the trades.
Do you think, speaking of your machine shop being broken into, do you think that too many national Democrats are too dismissive of the concerns of American citizens when it comes to crime, pointing to statistics and telling them that they're not experiencing what they're experiencing?
Yeah, I think that's a fatal flaw in the Democratic strategy, is people are always trying to explain things to people. They're obsessed with, you know, being right all the time. And, you know, I think that it's important to understand the underlying feelings around an issue and not just the statistics, because those statistics, unless you understand the facts on the ground, those statistics can sometimes be hollow.
You beat your opponent, Republican Joe Kemp, by only 2,600 votes yesterday. Despite being an election liar, he finally conceded after the recount. Are you confident you can represent a historically red district, especially with so many people in your district willing to put aside the fact that he was an election liar and vote for him? It was pretty close.
Yeah, I'm here to represent everyone, not just the people who voted for me. I think we have a lot of shared interests. Like I said, we all want a country that works again. We want opportunity for our kids. You know, I'm part of the generation that, you know, work as hard as I want. I'm not going to make as much money as my parents. And I think we are seeing an increasing, disenchantment, you know, with the way things are working for folks. You know, I'm running on really bread and butter issues. A right to repair laws are something that are really critical to me and one of the things I'll be working hard to pass in Washington, D.C.
Hey, our guest in this half hour is Teresa Purcell, who is the founder of the Rural Strong Network. Teresa, you were an advisor to that campaign. Tell me why this rural Democrat was able to succeed when so many others crashed and burned in 2022.
Well, and I want to say I was a volunteer advisor. I was an early supporter, but Marie was one of those people who had the courage to get in very early, and she showed up. She showed up in every corner of her district. She had conversations. She went, you know, she was the person who was showing up and listening to people and really got the disconnect. She got how hard things were. She got how, as oftentimes, one of the slogans I have for the Rural Strong Network is we show up, we shut up, and we get stuff done. Because one of the things that the Democrats have not done in rural places is we haven't shown up and we haven't listened. And again, the Biden administration and Democrats in Congress are doing that. And the other thing that Marie has done Congresswoman Perez that I, Glusin Camp Perez that I love saying that is, she actually is so real and she is so connected to people. She doesn't buy into the talking points. She doesn't buy into not standing up. She stands up to the Democratic Party for working people. She stands up on her, you know, she got a lot of pushback on really putting a stake in the ground on, we need to actually not just for have college forgiveness, but we need to make sure that people are investing in the trades. We need to make sure that people have access to trade certification and not just, it's not just the kind of white collar, college bound. Those are folks that the Democratic Party is gaining with, but we frankly, it's not enough people to win. And it's not enough people. We need to be able to govern. And we need to be able to have the relationships with working people, because those are the folks in rural places that are suffering. You know, one of the lines that we hear all the time that I've heard all the time and I've stolen from folks is, in a lot too many rural places, you either have three houses or you have three jobs. Because we live in beautiful, beautiful countryside, but we also have our populations that live there full time are impoverished. And I want to go to back to, if I can, the whole white rural rage framework is horrific. Clearly, those folks have never really interacted with rural people. And I would love to take on chapter and verse on their analysis. The analysis of the problem is not that far off, is white rural people have been left behind. But the other thing to keep in mind is that this, there are real solutions that include reinvestment in our communities, making sure that government is working in our communities, and frankly, showing up for our communities. We're closing hospitals. We don't have access to healthcare. We don't have access to mental health care. And as I said to a colleague of mine, you know, rural people hate trans people. And I'm like, no, they don't. They just are mad that the Democrats are talking about are prioritizing access to healthcare for trans people, and God bless trans people, but over access to healthcare for rural people. No one is talking about what our needs are in our communities, and we are being left behind. And are the people that are getting elected as Republicans, it part of the work of the Rural Strong Network is making it safe to be a Democrat in rural America again. Building a brand that says rural strong, building homegrown prosperity together, so people can signal to each other, centering on shared values and not partisan politics.
Well, let me ask you this question. She's, you know, if you look at her district, it's one of the, you know, top Republican targets for 2024. And my question is, the Biden message, as far as I can figure it out, is look at all the progress we've made on the economy since Donald Trump was president. Things are much better now. Will that message work for her in a reelection campaign and help her get reelected?
Actually, it will, because she's doing an excellent job of actually showing up in all these small communities and saying, hey, here's the $1 million that came through IRA for this community. Here's the several hundred thousand dollars that came through for this community. Here's the investments that the Republicans at the state level have said no to. Here are the individual investments that I've been able to bring into your rural community that Jamie Herrera Butler and didn't, and frankly, Joe Kent has no interest in doing anything good for the community. Here are the jobs that are being created. Here are the various investments that are actually at work in the community, and MGP's team is doing an excellent job of showing that she is in fact delivering for our communities. She is actually, I just, you know, look every day, you look at the newspaper in the district, and it's a big district. She is community by community going in and saying, these are the investments that are coming through the Biden administration and Democrats in Congress that are actually that actually benefit your community. And frankly, we're going to be amplifying that messaging all across the district and all across the country through the Rural Strong Network to show where people are making government work in their local communities. And we need to do more of that. And we need to be connecting with folks at the local level.
And do you think, well, let me ask you this question. Has the Democratic Party been receptive to your message about Rural Strong?
Yeah, people have been very. I was just in Michigan last week. I was the opening keynote at an event with 280 people. And yeah, they're very receptive. And again, it's about making it safe to have the conversation. Rural values are democratic values, and we just need to find ways to help people to help people make that case in their communities. And that's what we're doing. We're opening a different door for people to walk through to engage with the Democratic Party. I'm not a tool of the Democratic Party. I'm working with clients who are interested in helping rural communities thrive. And I'm working with folks who want to see us make sure that government is working. And this administration is doing a great job in making those investments. We just need to make sure they hit the ground.
Teresa, thanks for joining us today. Our guest in this half hour has been Teresa Purcell of the Rural Strong Network. I also want to thank Bob Deans of National Resources Defense Council for joining us in the first half hour. And of course, thanks to our intrepid executive producer, Mark Grimaldi, for helping me muddle through this the best we can. We'll be back with more of Deadline DC with Brad Bannon next Monday with a new set of exciting guests. So make sure you're with us. We'll look forward to seeing you again next Monday.